This is episode 27 of the Far Biddle podcast. Good to be with all the constant listeners. This is Nick Deolius. Now, who are we going to go with for our namesake on episode 27? Interestingly, I had a couple of options in the world of baseball and in a world of 70s baseball. I could have gone with two great pitchers, Catfish Hunter or Juan Marichal. Both would have been excellent choices. But instead, I thought there was an even better one. I am going to go with Carlton Fisk. That's the number 27 that he wore with the Red Sox, where he had the most noted part of his career. I think you guys know, I've brought this up before, I love 1970s baseball. I think it was the best era for baseball by far, from the players to the iconic teams. And Carlton Fisk, of course, is one of those key sort of players and actors in what is the best era of baseball. He had the home run career record for catchers until I think Mike Piazza came along in a more home run friendly, home run happy era for baseball. So up until then, it was Carlton Fisk who was the all-time career leader in home runs for catchers. Rookie of the Year in 72 when he showed up on the scene with the Red Sox. Hall of Famer, of course. But the statistics aside, what really sort of sets, I think, Carlton Fisk aside from the norm or from all the other really good players in that great era are just sort of a couple of key moments that he just epitomized. One, of course, was that 1975 World Series Game 6 at Fenway. Big Red Machine, right, versus the Red Sox, two just dynastic teams. And there's Fisk at the plate, hits the ball down the left field line, and he's trying to wave the ball to help it stay fair down that left field line. The ball actually hit the foul pole for the home run. And, you know, you created one of the classic moments in World Series lore and for baseball. A lot of people forget that was Game 6 of the 75 World Series. The Reds ended up winning Game 7. So despite all the theatrics and drama from Fisk, the Red Sox ended up losing the series. And urban legend has it that the cameraman who shot that scene when Fisk was sort of trying to wave the ball to keep it fair, he was not planning to do that. He was supposed to track the ball, but he was distracted by a rat at Fenway. So again, I don't know if that's urban legend or whether it's fact or not, but it makes for a great story. And then sort of the other side of the moments of Fisk, I really loved his fire and his drive. I think of a couple of key moments, both of which were against the Yankees. One, I don't know if you've ever seen this, but Thurman Munson and Fisk got into it at home plate during a suicide squeeze. I think it was Munson that was driving home and had a collision with Fisk, and the two of them went at it. Check that out if you haven't seen a video of that on something like YouTube. And then a second moment where Fisk was going at it because of his fire and determination was also against the Yankees. This time it was Lou Piniella, who was running home trying to beat a throw from the outfield, and massive collision at the plate. And the two of them got up and went at it for a good period of time. The benches cleared everything else. So again, I love 70s baseball, 1970s baseball, best era by far. I think for sure that is going to be a surefire popular topic for an upcoming Far Middle podcast. But nevertheless, for this episode 27, we're going to go with Carlton Fisk as the sponsor and namesake. Now let's take that player, Carlton Fisk, and the one thing many that he was noted for, which were those collisions at the plate with Munson and Piniella and the Yankees and other incidents. And I want to connect the topic of collisions in baseball to collisions in the real economy and the real world. And particularly here, I'm talking about collisions when you've got bad government policy or intervention that is coming together or meeting normal people and natural commerce. What happens when those two things collide? That's the theme we're going to explore in this episode 27 of the Far Middle. So let's go connect some collision dots, so to speak. And the first collision I want to discuss is when government, whether it be leftist politicians or the administrative bureaucracy, when it decides to intervene in education. And here I'm talking about public education at the grade school and high school levels. It's interesting to note, and I think it's really important to point out, that the Constitution throughout the entire document never mentions the word education. So the document doesn't say anything about the requirement of the state or government to provide education for its citizens. But yet you've got government running public education by what is effectively a self-justified edict. More and more of that is coming to the detriment of entities like the student and the taxpayer and our culture at large. And you see government and education and the resulting collisions that occur when that happens everywhere these days. I'll give you three very current and geographic examples of this at play. And the first one we'll start out with is on the West Coast in California. We talked about California on some prior episodes of the Far Middle, specifically Los Angeles, but California's got some of the largest school districts in the land. You think about some of the just big picture math here. There are 300,000 public school teachers in California. And at least let's assume, and this is going to be somewhat favorable statistics to give benefit of the doubt to great teachers. Let's assume that 5% of those 300,000 teachers are not doing their job. They're incompetent. That works out to at least 15,000 teachers across California not delivering on their job duty to properly educate kids. They're walking the halls and they're in the classrooms every single day. 15,000 of them. And that's why big city California school districts are posting abysmal student proficiency levels when you look at things like math competency and science competency and reading competency, which we covered, I think, in a number of prior Far Middle podcast episodes, and which also I discuss extensively in my upcoming book, Precipice. Now, would the real world tolerate that magnitude of incompetent professionals with doctors or surgeons? Would they tolerate that when it came to that many incompetent lawyers in one state, mind you, or pilots of airplanes? If not, then why do we have to endure it with the profession of public school teacher? And the answer, of course, is the government and its ally, the public union bureaucrat. They are colliding with meritocracy and great teachers in the real world, and that's creating a heck of a conflict. Our second geographic example is going to be New York City. So now that I can happily attach to Bill de Blasio's name exiting or departing or soon to be ex-Mayor de Blasio, let's talk about how in a pile of inept and horrible policies and decisions that de Blasio has imposed upon New Yorkers, one of the worst, I think, is his most recent, just before he's exiting office, which was killing the city's talented and gifted program for elementary school kids in the public school system. He killed the entrance exams for the four-year-olds that would look to be part of the 2,500 kid program every year. So there's 2,500 kids every year that were being elected and earning their way into these talented and gifted programs. And this decision comes from the leader and the leaders of a city whose public school system produces 10% proficiency for Black eighth grade kids in math and 14% efficiency for the same group in reading. And by the way, the state legislature in New York State, right, it caps the number of charter schools, which of course adds insult to injury. Now, the last geographic example, we had one on the two coasts, we had one on the California example and one in New York City. Let's jump over to Virginia, a little south of New York City. Education is a crucial issue to the entire society at large, right? All stakeholders care about education, but it's one of those issues that gets the rightful attention at times from voters because it affects their kids. So we saw this recently in the Virginia governor election where Youngkin won largely because of his position versus his opponent's position on what was being taught in Virginia's public schools and how much say parents should have on the curriculum. Education, I think it's one of those things that voters and particularly parents are going to get. And I'm hoping we see more reckoning on the state of our public education system and elections. Less government in the classroom, less public unions in schools, more meritocracy for teachers, particularly great teachers, and more choice via charters. They're all going to be welcome and good things for the student and for the city and for the taxpayer and for the economy and for the nation at large. Let's jump to another connection of collision when government meets the real world. Here we can discuss government colliding with science and how it results in hurting global health and making what was science now partisan science. The topic at hand, of course, is COVID and pandemic and how governments, including our own federal and state governments, deal with it and how they continue to address it and how much of it flies in the face of the scientific method and objective thought. I found the situation with the where and how COVID came about to be intriguing. You've got this wide swath of the so-called scientific community that effectively procures all of its funding from government, basically from the state. And from the get-go, before any facts and any investigation, scientific investigation, you had the portion of the Western scientific community that feeds from tax dollars publicly stating really strange things for scientists. So in The Lancet, that's one of those esteemed medical journals, The Lancet came out and said that, quote, "We reaffirm our expression of solidarity with those in China who confronted the outbreak there," end quote. So The Lancet again, that's one of these scientific journals that are stacked with people making money off of our tax dollars. They came out and then they also followed on with that prior quote and said, with a second quote, "We stand together to strongly condemn conspiracy theories suggesting that COVID-19 does not have a natural origin," end quote. So just a couple of thoughts looking at those two sort of excerpts from The Lancet. First, when you're talking about solidarity, solidarity is a political thing. It is not a scientific thing. And conspiracy theories, when you're labeling something a conspiracy theory, when it relates to investigating scientifically the origins of COVID, to me, that sounds like what legitimate scientists wouldn't call conspiracy theories. They would normally call those hypotheses, and they would pursue those and test those and explore those. And we don't know what the Chinese government did to confront the virus. So why are scientists in The Lancet standing in solidarity with something that you don't have the facts on yet and you don't have complete understanding with respect to yet? And lo and behold, the origins of COVID are now a very, very open question. So that's definitely something that has not been answered definitively by any stretch of the imagination. And worst of all, it looks like that the lab in Wuhan was funded in part with dollars and grants from the United States, which is, you know, code for our tax dollars. But these very same so-called U.S. scientists who stand in solidarity with their Chinese comrades had no oversight ability with respect to how those dollars were being spent or how the research was being conducted. Now, if non-scientists are to trust the scientific community on scientific matters, the swath of the scientific community, like the one speaking for The Lancet, should start sounding less like the minutes from a communist political commissar meeting and more like what the scientific method is supposed to represent, which is challenging and testing and modifying theories and hypotheses based on objective fact and observation. So these so-called scientists in places like The Lancet, they sound as if they are more concerned about falling in line, in solidarity, so to speak, with governments than with scientific truth. And until that changes, I'm going to remain really skeptical of what they've got to say. Now, thankfully, science and the private sector and the free market solved COVID and pandemic with vaccines. Let's stop the arresting of science by political science when government collides with science so that we don't end up paying more of a societal price. Now, while many people agree government interfering or colliding into education of our kids and science in the case of COVID has been devastating, a lot of people on the left and on the right actually agree that government got something correct when it comes to spurring investment into poor areas of cities and states. It's what is referred to as opportunity zones or OZs. Well, let me tell you, government intervening to impact capital investment flows in real estate, that is not a good thing. And these OZs, these opportunity zones, are not something government got right. OZs are something government got very wrong. And you should have known this wasn't going to work out well when the original concept was coming from an ultra-wealthy tech investor who wanted to develop this concept of opportunity zones to what he called democratize access to capital. Boy, that sounds awfully Elizabeth Warren-ish. OZs were supported by Republicans, including, of course, President Trump. They were supported by Democrats, including people on the Biden administration team. No public hearings on OZs. And it is heavily supported by the super wealthy because it's another example of how government and regulations are justified by helping investment in underserved communities. But in reality, when you look at them in reality, they're designed to provide tax havens and tax shields and more disposable income and greater net worth to wealthy individuals that can design a system and then ultimately game the system. Now, I did some digging, and you'll have to do some digging, because these OZs are covered in six little pages in the massive 2017 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. By the way, the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act and the affiliated regulations, they now exceed 1,000 pages in total. Not a word was written about OZs in any national paper that I could find before the law was passed. The media was either asleep or they chose to be silent. And those six pages where you've got these OZs covered in their entirety, they basically allow states and governors to designate where the OZs are. And right now, there's almost 9,000 of them across the United States. So they ended up blossoming like a weed, or perhaps a better term is like a virus. And some are in poor areas and others are not. The politician and government has the discretion to pick and choose which areas are blessed with this OZ tag. And OZs end up rewarding one thing. They're designed to reward one thing and one thing only. That is capital appreciation in real estate. So if you're rich, or if you're a Wall Street firm or a tech firm, and you have unrealized capital gains, guess what? You can reinvest that money and those unrealized capital gains into these OZs and enjoy tax shields and tax breaks. OZs are designed to increase the wealth of those investing their unrealized capital gains, which is a good subsidy for the wealthy. Now, social impact, it doesn't matter for OZs. That's what they're justified on. That's the theory behind them, at least on the surface. But there's nothing in the six pages of the rules with OZs that requires a social impact to be had, something tangible to be had. So the project created by the OZ does not need to benefit residents of the zone, whether they're poor or otherwise. And with the Federal Reserve printing and pumping free money and setting returns on things like fixed income to effectively zero, and with the incremental tax rates for the wealthy being high, guess what? It's no surprise that there is a big demand for the rich to pour billions of dollars into these OZs. You've got, I found this amazing, there are 50 conferences a year that are created to basically talk about how to optimize, refine, and game the OZ playbook. 50 conferences a year. Projects get built that would have been built without OZs and without the government subsidy. So what types of projects are sort of the creation of these OZs? You've got a Ritz-Carlton and the affiliated condos that were built in Portland. I'm sure Antifa in Portland is thrilled with that. You've got a Virgin Hotel that is being built or was built in New Orleans. How sustainable for Richard Branson. You've got things like self-storage units that are very popular that are being built using OZ funding. So there's not a lot of job creation with self-storage units. I don't have anything against self-storage units in and of themselves, but there's not a lot of jobs tied to them and doesn't exactly add aesthetic beauty to an urban space. And of course, you know, academia, they never miss out on subsidized bonanzas. You've got luxury student housing in university towns as a beneficiary of OZs as well. President Biden, he promised to reform OZs on the campaign trail in 2020, but guess what? No reform to date. I wouldn't hold your breath on that one. Critics call subsidized gentrification. That's what they've sort of tagged OZs. So people that don't like OZs or aren't fans of them like myself, they basically call it a form of gentrification subsidization. And OZs, they surely inflate real estate values and reduce home affordability in these areas, probably harming the very people the OZs were used in to justify their creation to begin with. And what more, though, do you expect other than the exact opposite of the warranted justification when, once again, government collides with the free market and capital investment to benefit the quote-unquote public good? That's always a surefire sign, tell sign that that something is amiss. And OZs and education in our largest urban areas are two specific examples of a general trend, which is our next dot that I want to connect. That trend is how government and its allies have been able to bring to bear for decades their full brunt in our urban areas and our urban core cities. This has been devastating to the middle class in cities, and it's created a tale of two cities in our urban areas, the very wealthy and the very poor. There is nothing in between. And this plays out everywhere. And I spent a lot of time highlighting this in detail in my upcoming book, Precipice. Yet every day there is another example of it at play. You almost can't keep up with the developments as they occur. And today I'll just give you one that I just came across in the past couple of days, which is in San Francisco. There was a recent news story on local Bay Area TV that was talking about how in downtown San Francisco, there are residents in an expensive new condo high-rise where the units are selling in excess of $1 million each. And these residents are living in fear because the high-rise abuts up against an alleyway where one of the largest homeless encampments in the city, and of course, since this is San Francisco, it's probably one of the largest homeless encampments in the country, is situated. So, you know, around this building where this encampment is, you've got drugs and needles and fights and robberies, and you got all kinds of health issues with human feces and urine and trash all over the place. They're all combining to create a quality of life problem for those affluent residents when they walk out past their doorman or when they drive out of the garage in their expensive cars. But this is exactly what one should expect when government collides with the free market in places like our large cities. The society starts to stratify into two classes of rich and poor. The middle class gets obliterated and run out of town. Cost of living skyrocket. Crime goes up, and basically everyone is feeling like they lost. the issue is not what is driving the abysmal state of San Francisco today. That's 100% clear if you're paying attention or being objective. Instead, the real issue is how are we going to stop this madness from spreading to all of our cities and all of our locales? This madness, it really manifests itself in strange ways. And that sort of brings us to our next collision when government decides to monkey wrench with the free market by offering subsidies for things like making movies, of all things. Now, like these other collisions we saw, what we see is some popular noble purpose, which in this case is creating jobs, right? So this is always going to be justified under the banner of creating jobs. What we don't see is government and mainstream media, and again, the mainstream media is supposedly there to check government, but they often don't do that, looking at the data and the facts. So government, media, they're not looking at data and facts because in reality, these subsidies do not create good jobs. And if anything, net-net, they're going to act to destroy decent jobs in the real economy because somebody has to pay for this. The subsidy has to come from somewhere. And typically that somewhere is going to be by appropriating the value of doers in the real economy. Michigan, along with its inept governor, is a great example of this type of a subsidy from the state or from government and how it's subsidizing Hollywood at the expense of the blue-collar factory worker at play. So it's sort of a subsidy for Hollywood out of state and coming at the expense of sort of the manufacturing sector and the blue-collar worker and the middle class. And the state of Michigan for years had a rich subsidy for movies and filmmakers, but then it finally came to its senses and scrapped them back in 2015. But then came pandemic and all that government relief and spending. And along with it came the opportunity to resurrect the Hollywood handout. And the bill's sponsor in Michigan was looking to revive the subsidy predictably by saying that, quote, this is about Michigan jobs, end quote. Again, a very noble and a very popular justification for it, but ends up being anything but. And why does it end up being anything but Michigan jobs, helping Michigan jobs? It comes actually to work against it. Well, you can see it when you look at the facts. And what I'll be giving you is sort of a comparison of Michigan's original film subsidy or movie-making subsidy bill. This was in 2008 that created film tax credits. And the data I'm giving you are coming from basically either think tanks or nonpartisan studies. So these aren't from one side or the other on the political spectrum of a Democrat or Republican. But first thing that a study came away with, which to me was the most striking, taxpayers, when you do the math of what the jobs were that were created in 2008, and you divided those number of jobs into the amount of subsidy that Michigan handed over to the film industry, the cost per job ended up being over $186,000 per job. That's a ridiculous amount of expense and subsidy to throw at some effort to create jobs on a per job basis. And then on top of it, most of these film jobs, they're non-permanent and they're temporary and they're part-time. And another study had shown that I think there were just over 2,700 short-term movie jobs that were created in the state. They basically had the same economic impact as 254 full-time year-round jobs. Now, that's over a 10-to-1 dilution in job economic impact if you look at what these film jobs were, which, again, are temporary, part-time, non-permanent in nature versus full-time jobs in state, 2,700-plus being equal to about 254 legitimate full-time jobs year-round. The return on a dollar of film subsidy invested shows between 14 and 27 cents that you get back. That's a horrible, horrible rate of return. And if this were a real business or in the real economy, that sort of embarrassing rate of return would wreck the venture, would wreck the business in a very short period of time. Wouldn't be done. It just simply would be scrapped. And those embarrassing returns and the value destruction that comes with it are only going to get worse when you consider that states and cities all over the country are offering up subsidies for things like making movies, and that creates a race to the bottom, where all these states are throwing more and more money and more subsidy to compete with each other to offer up all this ransom for the same number of movies or the same handful of movies that are going to be filmed. So the next time that you're out and about your city or your state and you see that there's a street closed because they're shooting a scene in a movie, or you're reading in the paper about some Hollywood actor who was walking around some trendy, hip, gentrified neighborhood and, I don't know, sitting in a coffee shop, Equate that to a surefire sign that your money is being pilfered by your elected leaders who are colluding with the entertainment mega entities. Don't be proud of your city or if your state gets to be the location for a value heist where the schemers are outsmarting and pilfering the oblivious. But when it comes to government colliding with your money, the real economy and things and facts and rate of returns and taxpayer rights, those things are never going to matter. They're going to get bowled over by the elite politicians and by the rent-seeking subsidy consumers like those that you see in Hollywood. So as we come down the home stretch of episode 27 of the Far Middle Podcast, let's wrap this up by one final collision that we will connect. And that is going to be what happens when you've got science, government, and the Church of Climate Change all coming together. This just in for those of you fearing the end of days from climate change. I think you'll find this interesting and entertaining. Last year, back in 2020, our public servants that were working in Glacier National Park out there in Montana, they were removing signs. And the signs that they were removing was stating that the park's glaciers would be gone by 2020. So obviously 2020 came, glaciers are still there in Glacier National Park. So the Park Service employees were taking down those signs. Now, were those workers climate deniers? You get the feeling sometimes this is like one of those religious cults where the leader is predicting the end of the world or aliens arriving by a date certain. The date comes, nothing happens, and then everyone looks around and says, now what? Hey, I hope you enjoyed this episode of The Far Middle. You can follow me on Twitter at Nick Deolius. Check out the website, nickdeolius.com. And go pre-order your copy of Precipice, which will be out in mid-January 2022, but it is up for pre-order on Amazon and Barnes & Noble and Indie Books. I'll talk to you soon with episode 28. Until then, stay safe.